with the two together, we worked out that paper. And it was the first time that in an international organization a resolution of this time was coming, it came up. In the League of Nations, I think there was no precedent of that. And that was an agreement that had already been signed. It was an agreement on coffee, Inter-American, within the Inter-American framework. And that was working so-and-so, but we wanted that to be extended. And the United States did say no. It was a very plain no, the type of no that the great powers can voice with some authority, so that there was nothing doing. And it was not withdrawn in, I would suggest, but it remained undiscussed practically. It was a very representation from Venezuela and perhaps a couple of countries that did observe something, but from there on it didn't go any further. That was something that I remember well, because I had something to do with that, and it is a matter which is still in our agenda today.
Very much so.
And we had have the same difficulties we had before.
Right. Except UNCTAD today, right?
UNCTAD today, yes. Except that some agreements have been signed, but we know that there are some countries, particularly one, that is not very happy with that idea, because they believe in market as being the determining factors of everything else, including, of course, of prices. But still, that's another matter.
Well, let's move on to 1945 in San Francisco. What was your role in the Venezuelan delegation in San Francisco? Did you concentrate on particular areas of the charter, or what was your role?
I was at the beginning wavering, because I was very much interested in the economic side, in what was concerned in the ECOSOC. But in the end, Parapérez thought that I might be more useful in the political side, and he put me in the first commission, I think it was, or in the commission that discussed the security arrangements, the Security Council, everything else. Well, the veto came up, the veto question came up. And we were in favor of the veto, not because we liked, we were enthusiastic about it, but we could not see the organization becoming a practical institution if we did not recognize the prerogatives of the two great powers, the ones that and others that had helped in a determining fashion in the winning of the war. And of course, we didn't think that it was going to stay for forever, but at least for a number of years after the war, it was Parapérez's thinking that I shared, that was worthwhile having. And it was called the rule of unanimity at the time, that the two major powers have to be unanimous on something in order that the resolution should pass. Of course, the veto power was somehow attenuated by the possibility of an abstention of one of the permanent members of the Council, the Security Council, without making it hindering the approval of the resolution.
Now tell me, we've lived with the veto for 37 years. From your perspective, both as an international civil servant and as a diplomat, has it been a help or a hindrance to the work of the UN? Has the veto been abused?
The veto has been abused by both powers. Yeah. When we say both, I suggest it are the two major powers.
Yes.
Others might have also done a number of things. In the case of the War of Malvinas, I think there was a use of the veto power by the UK, which was also, in our view, an abuse, but it was the use of the veto power that was provided for by the Charter.
Mm-hmm.
We can interpret it as not being called for in a matter of this type, except for very short-sighted interest of one of the powers, or the vetoing power, but nothing else. But I don't see how it could have been otherwise. You could not help thinking that...
You wouldn't have had a charter unless you had the veto, I guess.
No. Or if you had had one, it would have broken up very soon thereafter. Mm-hmm. Or it would have been even less workable, because somehow the Security Council would not have met, or something that would have happened, which would have paralyzed the institution rather than make it more workable.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I would suggest that the time has come, it has come, or it has been there for some time, when a reconsideration of this matter ought to take place. Not that it should be entirely removed as such, but it should be said when it can be, let's say, used in a legitimate way and when not. No?
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, this is something that will take some time before it is settled. Huh? We were in that position, but there were other Latin American countries that were in a different position. For instance, Colombia, which is a country very close to ours, and it's immediate brothers of ours, I mean, or sisters. So that they were in the position that the veto should not have been conceived as an instrument for the Charter of the United Nations. And they made a very good speeches, much better than ours, in that respect, because it was, of course, it lent itself to putting straight an argument, in the interest of the developing countries. They were not called that way at the time, but the smaller countries, and of course the medium-sized countries as well. Even some European countries had some doubts about it, but they could not do anything but let the veto go through. And that was happened there. It was a great majority in favor of it. And in the end, since we did not vote or anything of that type, because we were writing a charter, it was a constitution, I mean, because the predominant feeling was that it should be there, I mean, those that were against it had to give in. And I mean, most of them did it in a very elegant way, no? Without being forced to do, but just agreeing that indeed that was the only way at the time.
What were your expectations when you arrived in San Francisco? Did you think that we were going to get a charter and we were going to get as good a charter as we did? I mean, were you optimistic about it?
I was optimistic because I had already had the background of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the Dumbarton Oaks memorandum or proposals, but also the conversations with Sumner Wells, or the correspondence with Governor Wells, between Sumner Wells and Parra Pérez, the minister with whom I worked, so that I could see that it was following a line which was not too different, if not different in a substantial way, from the one that had been traced before.
Uh-huh.
But more organically put, in Dumbarton Oaks, and it made sense, as I said before, because it covered pretty well the economic matters and also the colonial matters, the need for the self-determination on the part of colonies. That was two things on which Venezuela was very insistent. Of course, in the case of Parra Pérez, he was very much interested in peace,
yeah,
as such. But he conceived, as we have conceived since then, that peace could not exist if justice, economic justice, would not prevail in the world. And that's why the world is still not at peace, because not enough has been done and on that score, on the score of economic matters,
yes,
and bringing about an equitable system with which we could all live.
Which is something you've been working on most of your life.
That is it, yes. And I will be working until I will pass away, I hope.
We have talked quite a little bit about the inter-American system, the Organization of American States, the Pan-American Union, and so on. That was one of the major issues which Venezuela was interested in.
That is it, yes.
At San Francisco, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that was one of the key. That was my impression from the reading I've done. In fact, it was one of the key issues for the Latin American states. Am I correct?
That's it, yes. And right. Parra Pérez has very much to do with that, because when, as I said before, when Senator Vanderbilt rose that question, that in derogation, what are we going to do? Because the United States could not sign it if we don't have some provision which would cover that situation,
mm-hmm,
the situation of a regional conflict. And what would be the competence of the United Nations vis-à-vis the competence of another regional organization, in that case, the Pan American Union at the time, the OAS, as this has come to be known. So that this was pursued there, but I would suggest it was perhaps 2 weeks before the end of San Francisco Conference.
Exactly.
It was during at least the final third.
Is it that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was late that it came up. And I think Senator Vanderbilt and Parra Pérez, but I would suggest Senator Vanderbilt more so than Parra Pérez because he had more power, brought it up.
Yeah.
We had another gentleman whose name was Gustavo Herrera, was Minister of Development in Venezuela, who was dealing with these questions because he was very much interested in inter-American relations, and he was the one also who helped Parra Pérez most in these matters. Not I myself, who was a junior at the time. And I think it came out all right. We were a little bit afraid that it might become an obstacle to the signing of the charter itself, or to the completion of the work. At one time, it was the only issue that really could have meant a stoppage of the whole thing.
My goodness.
Yeah. And we were told that that was the case. I still remember the anxiety that we had all. It was the only time when we could see that the charter might remain a wishful thinking. It did not, because people were flexible and were very much interested in having an organization. So that those that thought that the competence should be given to the Organization of American States, the Pan-American Union at the time, had to give away to those that were thinking that the competence had to be global in the case of the United Nations. So that a sort of a compromise was worked out. And that compromise is what we see in these articles of the Charter, 56, I don't recall that one. That is very clear. There are a couple of articles that one says that the Security Council has got full competence from everything.
Right.
And the other says, in certain circumstances, it may go to
regional. Now, I believe that at San Francisco there was a move to have one of the non-permanent seats on the Security Council reserved for the Latin American group. Was Venezuela a part of that campaign? And how do you feel that the present rotational arrangements for the non-permanent seats on the council worked out?
Venezuela was never very much involved in that idea of trying to get permanent seat for Latin America. To begin with, because it would not be permanent, we were ourselves 20-odd countries, and we knew very well that we were not going to be represented just because any one of these countries would be a member there.
Right.
A member has to act on its own and cannot receive instructions from 20 members of a group. So that we did not take that very seriously. There were some countries that thought that if they may have had that seat, they might have stayed there.
Yeah.
Because of their size, because of their importance. Venezuela was certainly not of any dimension that would have commanded that authority. And so that we did not press that, not even testified our own interest in that matter. Yet, we were very much interested that Latin America would be well represented in the Security Council among the non-permanent members. And that, I think, we succeeded in getting a sort of understanding of that. It was not done in a precise fashion. And since Latin America was the only important group of the Third World at the time that was independent, except for India and Thailand and Ethiopia and a number of other countries, I mean, Egypt, that was not quite entirely independent, but still had an independent status. I mean, we did not fear at the time any competition from other members of the Third World. And what has worked out has been all right. I mean, I think it has worked all right. And it's a question more of quality than of number. That's what's important there. Of course, numbers do have their own significance, since even for a resolution to be adopted, there is a need for 7 members at the time. I think it's 9 now.
Mm-hmm.
So that numbers count, as I say. But this part of it has been working all right so far, as I know.
Yeah.
The only thing is this, small states that would like to be members of the council, and they have a right. They have a right, since we have got equality of states, equality of status for all the states. I mean, there's nothing that we can say.
Sure.
And it is for the United Nations General Assembly and the Security Council to choose.
Tell me, what was the atmosphere like at San Francisco? Was there hostility, suspicion, mistrust?
No.
Or genuine spirit of cooperation?
There was a genuine spirit of cooperation. Yeah. I suggest some of the countries, like Saudi Arabia, for instance, was very new. My first conversations on oil with Saudi Arabia date from that time.
Exactly.
And from the train taking us to San Francisco with some of the younger chaps of the Saudi Arabian delegation. And I told them that a lot of oil existed in their countries which they didn't know about. They knew that some of it existed, but they didn't know that it was really very big. And we Venezuelans were much more informed on that.
You knew more about it than they did.
Than they did. Yes, indeed, at the time.
That's fascinating. A question about the working methods at the San Francisco conference. Did the Latin American states maintain regular or continuous consultation? Did they often vote as a bloc? Did they consult with other third world nations? You were mentioning, say, Saudi Arabia or the Philippines or Thailand. What was the working method there?
At that time, it was not a group method that was followed. The so-called OECD countries today meeting on their own, or the middle countries meeting on their own outside the great powers, or anything of that type. What there was very much in practice there was the method of consultation, informal consultations. And Para Perez would see many people that would come to see him, or he would ask to see other people. He had meetings, of course, with the head of the delegation of the United States, as with the head of delegations of the Soviet Union at the time, or others of the other groups, France, of course, and others. But Latin American group did not exist as such. It did not meet as such. And not everyone was of the same feeling at the time. In Latin America, we had some difficulties, as you know, so that we were not necessarily all of the same opinion, as I told you about the veto, the case of the veto. But still, among certain countries, there were, if not regular, at least frequent consultations. The conference lasted for over 3 years, for 3 months.
Yeah.
So that there was ample time for consultations and living together, because most of us lived in the St. Francis Hotel, so that we were meeting all the time. No? And not only at the top level, but also at the medium and lower level, which was important, though, to create that atmosphere.
Right.
Of cooperation and of goodwill. I mean, people wanted to finish this war with international organizations that would work and prevent another war for succeeding that one, which we have not yet made sure of.
Your reply immediately inspires two further questions. What was the relationship of the Latin American nations with the Soviet Union at San Francisco? Did you, at that time, sense the beginnings of the Cold War rivalry between the Soviet Union and the United States?
I would suggest, from what I can recall, that there was not too much spoil at the time by the tensions that followed, more particularly because of the Polish situation and then later for the Iranian situation. Already when the United Nations had already been accepted, the charter was already been ratified or was under ratification. There were problems, of course, which we could surmise. The interested powers knew more about it than we did, and about the possibility of this evolving into some tensions that might have caused another war. But we were not aware of it, and nobody wanted to be aware at the time when we were discussing the peace as a major issue. It would have been an unwelcomed issue to bring in this question. And Molotov, that was a hard man and so forth, had more smiles than I had suspected, and was very pleasant when he would meet a member of the American delegations and so on. And we, of course, talked about it among ourselves what about our impressions of this or that band? And there was some, I would suggest, rather definite, in Spanish we say simpatías, empathy with the Russians for their contribution in winning the war.
Uh-huh.
And that was very clear since the Battle of Stalingrad and then the Battle of Berlin. That was some tremendous events that had a great widespread resonance. But the younger people probably were more caught by this type of feeling than the older ones that were somewhat more mistrustful of what might happen. No? But in any case, I didn't even feel that among my American friends. I had very good relations with some of the Americans there at my category. And we never thought that we were going to have this very tense relationship that we had a few years later.
Now, this brings me to my second question, and that is about the United States. What was the influence of the U.S. on the Latin American delegation, and specifically on Venezuela, during this San Francisco conference? Did you feel you were being pressured by Washington?
I don't think so. Let me reflect if I can find any trace in my remembrances about something of this type. I don't see anything. I suggest that the matter on which they were brought closer together is this question of the role that the OAS, the Inter-American Organization, would play within this peace ensuring mechanism. But not, for instance, in the economic matters, which we discussed very fully, where they're insistent that we should try to leave out something that might have not been very good. We enriched very much the clauses of the what Don Barton Oaks had on an economic organization, economic competence of the League, of the United Nations. And it was welcomed by them. Of course, there were discussions, and we had to admit that perhaps we had to give way in some things, but generally speaking, it came out very much along the lines which we wanted. We cannot say that we missed putting something. Some of the things were perhaps not sufficiently developed there, but not excluded just because of pressure of the big ones.
Now, Nelson Rockefeller was at the conference.
Yes.
Did he make his presence felt with the Latin American delegation?
He used to keep in touch with Latin American delegations. Yeah.
That's putting it very tactfully, I'm sure.
Huh?
That's putting it very tactfully, I'm sure.
Tactfully. No, but he was a friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And he still was a friend of ours when we had a revolutionary government a year about that was the same year, later on that year, in October, when Romulo Betancourt came to the government. And he kept good relations with Nelson Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to visit Venezuela from time to time. He had some property there.
Yes, he had property there, yes.
And I knew him well, too. But, of course, so we knew who he was and whose interests he was serving. But there was not necessarily, I would suggest, an incompatibility among his interests in every matter, no? Except on oil. Sometimes. We did not consult them to do a few things that we did.
Now, one of your proposals at San Francisco was for an international institute for educational, social, and cultural cooperation. What was your role in formulating this proposal? This was a Venezuelan proposal, as I understand.
Yes, yes.
I presume that this could be described as a forerunner of UNESCO.
Of UNESCO, yes. We did that because we had felt that within even the Inter-American states, we had to have something of this type. And that was not enough to have it at the regional level, but it should be a worldwide network of knowledge and science. And that was, of course, as you say, a forerunner. But the other countries of Latin America were very keen on as well. Mexico and Colombia were very much interested in these matters at the time, and the southern part of it too, as well.
Tell me, Ambassador, has UNESCO become the agency you originally envisioned?
I can say that not even of myself, let alone of an organization that's grown so much as UNESCO. I did not envision myself as I am today. And UNESCO is certainly different from what it was thought it might be. But I would suggest that it has developed perhaps too much, as has happened to many international organizations, in terms of bureaucracies, but not in terms of coverage, of scope. Because I think whatever they have covered had a reference, a very important reference, to knowledge in the world, no?
Yes.
Including information, which is so much of a matter of contention right now.
Mm-hmm.
We never questioned that the competence of UNESCO of taking up these matters and seeing what we could do with it.
Mm-hmm.
We are all for the free press and everything else, but freedom up to a point, because it's not a question of having censorship or anything, but having some discipline about things that would be in the interest, the general interest, and those that are merely on the promotion of specific interests, which sometimes are in a better position to pay their own way into the press rather than others.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean.
You have been very close to these things.
One of the provisions written into the charter at San Francisco was the possibility of a charter review conference after 10 years. And largely because of the reluctance of the Soviet Union and the United States, such a conference has never been held. How do you feel about this issue? Is it time for a full-scale charter review conference, or do you think that would just open up a Pandora's box?
I generally think that one should not be afraid of opening up any boxes, whether Pandora's or anyone else. Because otherwise we may not have anything. We would not have discussed many things. Or we would have needed another war to do something else. And as it was need for having a first war to have the League of Nations and a second world war to have the United Nations. And I think we ought to be able to discuss things among ourselves and trying to see reasonably what type of provisions could be changed or what kind of modifications certain provisions should be gotten or else. We would leave things as they stand and then perhaps they would become anachronic. So it's better to bring them to actuality, to the present day world, rather than to leave things as they stood before. I think, for instance, it's not very elegant to have nowadays in the Charter of the United Nations these clauses on the enemy states.